foundation on.
Come to order. Today's agenda is a initial hearing and possible work session on six different measures. We're going to start with House Bill 2447. Linda, could you give us a very thumbnail explanation of the effect of the measure, and then we'll take our witnesses.
Okay, Mr. Chair and committee members, the purpose of this bill would be to require that the correction division reimburse local governments, that is cities and counties, for their costs in detaining parole and probation violators in the local correctional facilities. Are you interested in fiscal?
Yes, I think that's
that
probably.
Question? Okay, we don't have a fiscal impact statement as such from the committee, from the fiscal office yet, but in a phone conversation today with Neil Chambers of the Corrections Division, they ran a check run on February 4th of local facilities and found that there were 220 persons being held at the request of the Corrections Division. It didn't mean necessarily that that was the sole reason they were being held, but there was a Corrections Division employee who had requested the hold. He figured it on the basis of a range from $25 to $57 per day cost of housing, and then assuming a $40 per day average times 221 inmates times 730 days in the biennium, there was a 1983-85 fiscal impact of $6,424,000 and an 85-87 impact of $7,066,400. As he explained, that only covers the ones with a corrections division employee warrant or order. If you included all, the bill does encompass a broader range than that, which would make it higher. For example, he didn't include people held from other states, held on parole board or court warrants, or perhaps even misdemeanors who had never come under the, could have been put on probation, be probation violators, and never had been given over to the jurisdiction of the corrections division.
Questions of Linda before we take testimony? Representative Springer.
Linda, it's my understanding that a fairly significant number of the people that are being held on a detainer, the charge is a new crime has been alleged. Were you able to get more discrete breakdown as to persons who likely would have been in custody in any event?
No, he didn't know the number on that, but he knew all that they had broken it down to was those where at Corrections Division employee had requested a hold. There wasn't a further breakdown of whether there were new crimes committed, as I understood what he told me anyway.
Thank you.
Further questions before we begin the hearing? Sheriff Dolan?
Chairman Myers, members of the committee, I am Jack Dolan, Sheriff of Benton County, and representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. There are basically two reasons why we're interested in this bill from the local level. One is to provide some funds to care for parole violators housed in our local facilities, and you've heard the impact, which seems to be fairly close to what we've identified as potential cost to us by housing parole violators. Probably the more important one, however, because of our continuing local crowding problems, is to provide some incentive to the state, and of course a negative incentive, to more promptly process parole violators.
This I think would definitely be an incentive.
I think part of it's brought about by the fact there are inadequate number of hearings officers that exist in the state, so the hearings are delayed. And the problem generally results when all local charges or local matters are resolved, and the only thing holding the person there in our local facility is the parole violation. And that's generally the problem. We're not nearly as concerned when they're there on a new charge that's our responsibility, our cost. But that process is over. They're either sentenced or acquitted, or maybe the length of the sentence is the period of time that they've already served pre-trial, and we have the parole violation still hanging over them, which keeps them there longer. So that's the biggest problem. Our costs on various jails across the state, you know, so we've left the amount blank. The highest is about $75 a day. Lane County, which is about in the middle now, is run about $54 a day. So the $40 figure may be even low if you look at the facilities that are housing the bulk of the parole violators. I'd be glad to gather any information for you if you wish, or answer any questions I can now.
Let me make sure we're clear now. You are primarily concerned about those individuals who are occupying local jail space for reasons independent of a new crime being charged?
Correct.
Is that right?
That's the biggest concern, yes.
Now, we, of course, have started looking at this problem earlier in connection with the restoration of the time limit, which was inadvertently removed from the statute in 81 concerning the, the time limit in that case is what? It's the time for... In the course of that consideration, the question came up about imposing a fixed time limit for the actual disposition by the parole board of the question of revocation or not. And that is one approach toward, that's not a financial incentive approach exactly, but that is one approach we are going to be looking at.
I think in one case our local judge made that determination himself and said that parole authorities hadn't made a decision by a certain time, he would release the person. I think in many cases we can release a person maybe by security release agreement or other kinds of conditional releases, and yet the revocation is what's hanging over the person's head, so we just can't get them out of our facility.
Do you have statistics for your own county, or more broadly for the state as a whole through your association, as to the average length of time that individuals are being held until the issue of revocation of parole has been resolved?
I wouldn't want to shoot from the hip, but I can sure gather it for you and provide it to your committee.
Did we get that? Have we gotten that from any other source yet?
I'm sorry, what was
the average length of incarceration at the local level?
We have some
to
numbers.
The point of decision on revocation.
We have some numbers that were recently sent in that I haven't reviewed yet from unhealthy.
Is that Pat Garris's memo?
Yes. Yes, I'm not sure exactly what way she framed her response.
I think that was just the numbers of individuals at a fixed point in time or over a certain period of time who were in local facilities for alleged probation or parole violations.
I think at that time she hadn't been able to break down whether of those numbers, how many had been held beyond the 15-day period. At least in her preliminary look, she hadn't been able to determine it.
Somewhere in the range of 45 days sticks in my mind, but I'd want to verify that before I quote it as an accurate statistic.
Do you have any way of capturing that statistic for us?
I sure do, in my local facility, and I may in those facilities that are operating on the range system, which would be Marion, Polk, Yam Hill, and Benton. We should have that information computerized.
One other question. At this time, in terms of the individuals we're concerned about, are you're getting no state reimbursement for your costs?
None whatsoever.
Mr. Springer, did you have a question?
No.
Further questions? Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Paul Snyder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I would simply endorse the comments made by Sheriff Dolan. As I've indicated in testimony before, we're taking a much closer look at the factors that result in jail overcrowding, much as this committee is, as prison overcrowding. I think this is a factor, one approach to trying to alleviate one aspect of that problem and the costs associated with it. And for those reasons, we endorse this measure.
I would assume, maybe you know or don't know, Paul, I would assume that the Corrections Division budget as submitted does not have any proposed appropriation for this process, for this purpose.
No, I don't think it does, Mr. Chair. As you've indicated, there are other approaches to deal with the problem. My principal purpose is for everyone to become aware of the problem, try and deal with it in some fashion.
Well, it remains to be seen whether this committee will want to make a political statement vis-a-vis Ways and Means with regard to this particular problem in the form that's proposed here. I happen to think that would be about what it would amount to. It would probably be a political statement, which, given the magnitude of the dollars possibly involved, is just out of the question for this biennium. But apart from that, I will assure you that this committee is going to continue to pursue the issue of tightening the process, the timetable by which the decision with respect to revocation must be made, independent of what may happen with this here or in Ways and Means. And we will be keeping you informed on that.
I think that'd be a help, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Questions of Mr. Snyder? Is there anyone from the Corrections Division to speak to this issue? They're taking the view that
No, I would just say for myself, Mr. Chair, that I agree with you. I think that
I think we've got to explore perhaps the less monetary, expensive ways of resolving the problem of getting people out, these people out of the system.
I have on my to-do list, but simply haven't gotten to it yet, set up a meeting with Hazel Hayes to talk about the issue of the pegging statutorily a fixed time limit within which the revocation process must be completed. Though I indicated at the hearing when that concept was broached that Hazel reacted with alarm, it's my understanding in some brief follow-up discussion that the board is not by any means adverse to trying to come to terms with that fashion, and that I think she is trying to work through to a more decentralized administrative process by which that might occur. Anything more from the subcommittee on 2447? 2449, Linda, would you
Mr. Chair, this bill would involve in certain decisions and procedures involved in death investigations that are now controlled basically by the medical examiners and in certain instances the district attorney. This would add certain law enforcement agencies into the process involved in death investigations.
Which one? 3448.
Which law enforcement agencies talking about?
Dr. Brady, were there any questions of Linda before we hear from Dr. Brady?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brady. I am a physician presently employed by the state of Oregon to direct their death investigation program. Technically, I'm known as the state medical examiner. I am here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2448. During my brief outline, I would certainly welcome any questions that you might have as I go along. Don't hesitate to stop me. House Bill 2448 is a very significant piece of legislation. This bill would have a profound and lasting effect on Oregon's death investigation program. It would restore to the state of Oregon the concept of the elected sheriff coroner. It would extend this concept in some rather unusual fashions. It would create an extraordinary situation that, to my knowledge, exists nowhere else in the country. It would change my office from an independent state operation to an arm of law enforcement. It would lead to a restoration of a death investigation system that the state of Oregon abandoned 25 years ago. So that you might understand basically where we were then and where we are now, allow me a few minutes to discuss the history, if you will, of our present system. In the general election of 1956, the surveyor and the coroner were removed as constitutional offices in the state of Oregon. The legislature in 1958 established our present death investigation system with one exception. The county of Multnomah was excluded from the system for a variety of very interesting political reasons. And in the general election of 1965, I ran as a Democratic candidate on the platform of abolishing the coroner in Multnomah County as an elected office. And the campaign of 1964 was fought on that issue. I was elected coroner with the help of the Oregon State Legislature. Multnomah County joined the state medical examiner system, and the state became a single unified operation. In 1972, the present legislation, which is now ORS 146, was written. This was written by the Criminal Law Revision Commission, existent at that time. The law completely abolished the previous death investigation program, which was basically a mishmash of the 1859 coroner law with some superimposed systems. We completely eliminated, started off with a blank piece of paper, and the legislature, with the support of the Oregon State District Attorneys Association, the Oregon State Funeral Directors Association, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon State Medical Association, passed a piece of legislation unanimously. It received no adverse votes in either the House or the Senate, nor to my knowledge did it receive any adverse votes in either of the House or Senate committees. It was opposed only then, as apparently it is now, by the Sheriff's Association. The legislation, ORS 146, is based on three fundamental principles. The whole law is written around these three basic concepts. Number one, death is not in and of itself a crime. The mere fact that a person dies does not require that a police agency investigate that death as a murder. And I assume most of us have had parents who have died, and we can understand that concept. The second fundamental concept is that what we have, while we have a statewide network, we have a local death investigation program. This is supported and supervised, but not controlled or directed by a state office. And I'll explain in a minute the mechanics of that. The third fundamental principle of ORS 146 is that the district attorney, as an elected prosecutor, has a strong role in the death investigation program, because as we are all well aware, there are deaths, suspicious deaths, deaths involving criminality or suspected criminality, and we believe very strongly that the district attorney, the elected law enforcement officer of the community, should have a strong role, and he does. What ORS 146 does is very, very carefully, and this took months of work in a variety of committees and hearings and so forth, balance the concept of the authority to investigate deaths with the responsibility for that investigation. In Oregon each year there are 20,000 deaths. Round figures, it's remarkably consistent from year to year. Of those 20,000 people that die in the state of Oregon each year, less than 150 are murdered. Therefore, the proportion, the relation of homicides to total deaths is less than 1%. ORS 146 places the responsibility of investigating deaths of public concern, accidents, suicides, suspicious deaths, drug deaths, deaths in police custody, deaths that may have a hazard, an impact on public health, deaths of persons who die without medical attention. These deaths must be investigated in each county by a physician, statutory requirement. That physician is appointed by the state medical examiner with the approval of the Board of Commissioners of that county, so that the responsibility of selecting a responsible physician, a trained professional, who in my opinion is a responsible member of that community, is balanced by having the elected representatives of that community, the Board of County Commissioners, approve that appointment. This county physician then selects other physicians to help him or her, so that we have a total of approximately 300 men and women who act as physician medical examiners throughout the state of Oregon. Now, in 1983, the practice of medicine depends on paramedical personnel. We all understand that. We don't go into hospitals and meet doctors. We meet receptionists. Our blood is taken by laboratory technicians. So, too, does this physician-based operation depend on paramedical personnel. And our paramedical personnel are law enforcement people. Law enforcement people, God bless them, have a very strong role, supportive role in our program. Number one, statutorily, there must be a representative of the Oregon State Police and the county sheriff as deputy medical examiner in each county. Number two, we have, at the present time, 700, more than 700 law enforcement officers throughout the state of Oregon who are individually selected and individually appointed, not by the state office, but by the local medical examiner and the district attorney. These people have each individually been trained by myself or one of the physicians in our program. They have completed an 8 to 12 hour training program. They have completed a 250-question test, which obviously influences their appointment. And once this has been completed, if the local medical examiner and the district attorney feel that these people can provide positive service to them, they will be appointed as deputy medical examiners with a strong role in our program, so that we have not in any way, in my opinion, excluded law enforcement personnel. We need them, we depend on them, they have a strong role. But where we disagree with this law is that the law enforcement personnel in our program are specifically trained, specifically appointed, again, by the local people who know them, not by myself. Furthermore, the state office does not play any role in establishing the qualifications for these local appointments. In other words, the deputy medical examiners in Portland may have quite different responsibilities than those appointed in Lane County or in Clackamas County or certainly in Marion County. What are the advantages of the present operation of our program? We have an extremely strong program with numbers of outstanding people. We have outstanding law enforcement people who are the backbone of our operation. We have been able, by virtue of having a strong program, with balanced authority and responsibility, we have been able to attract, as I indicated earlier, over 300 physicians to participate in our program. And while most of these people are compensated, they are not compensated excessively, and they represent, to a large extent, a donation of valuable time to a local death investigation program. Should the proposed legislation pass, I would anticipate a significant number of these men and women would have serious reservations about their role in the operation. Number two, it is a strong referral program. The present proposed legislation, 2448 in front of you, would change that referral program in a fashion, frankly, that I don't completely understand. The referral program right now is from the local agency to the physician consultant, who is usually the local pathologist, in the same way all of us are perhaps referred if we become ill and go to our local physician. If the illness is indeed severe, we may be sent up to the medical school. If the death anywhere in the state of Oregon is of significant, causes a significant problem, if it is of significant importance, that case is reported to our office. One of the three full-time state salaried physicians in Portland or the part-time state salaried physician in Lane County, Dr. Ed Wilson, will, at no local cost, perform the autopsy. The state office will do all of the necessary toxicology, and we have one of the finest laboratories in the nation. We will do all of the testimony, all of the pretrial testimony, and of significant importance, I think, with a very, very important potential fiscal impact on this legislation in front of us, is our association with the Public Defender's Office. Jim Hennings and the men and women in his office regularly, consistently come in and review their cases with us, because we are now, and we have been for 25 years, an independent agency. They do not regard us as an arm of law enforcement, and they have in almost no cases requested significant amounts of state money to bring in other pathologists, other experts, other people to do autopsies. And while I can't predict what their reaction would be should this legislation pass, there is a strong potential fiscal impact in that situation. What we do is to provide a uniform level of service throughout the state of Oregon. The full-time physicians in Portland and in Lane County provide to all the smaller communities and all of the larger communities in Oregon a level of professional expertise that is as uniform and as even and as balanced as it is almost possible to attain anywhere in the nation. Our program is looked on as a model throughout the country. We recently completed a book, which is a manual of our office operation. We have already sold hundreds of these books outside of the state of Oregon, because people in multiple states throughout the West Coast, people in states as far east as Maine and Virginia, North Carolina, look on our system as a model. They admire it, they respect it, and many of them are attempting to imitate it. I sincerely hope that the committee today will not attempt to turn the clock back 25 years to the elected coroner sheriff situation which we left. Our present system works. We're proud of it. I think you have reason to be proud of it, and I ask for and would appreciate your support in continuing our operation.
Questions? Doctor, we will be taking testimony from the proponents, and I think if you could remain for a few minutes, we may have some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Some dialogue in the wake of that that might help the subcommittee further.
My time is available to whatever I can do to help you this afternoon, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Groen.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, my name is Ken Groen. I'm the president of Sheriff of Lynn County, president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. In listening to Dr. Brady's testimony, I don't think there's a great deal that he said that the sheriffs are in opposition to. I think we pretty well agree with most of the things he said. The thing we're in great disagreement of is if you read the present law, it provides for the medical examiner's office and the district attorney to determine cause of death. We most certainly think that ought to be the way it is now. But there's no provision in there for law enforcement to investigate the perpetrators of the crime, to track down the evidence that goes on for months and sometimes years after the death. In this particular or current law, that's the district attorney's responsibility. We can't conceive that the legislature ever intended to leave law enforcement entirely out of death investigations, especially as it relates to homicide and so forth. What has happened as a result of this bill, many of the overzealous district attorneys have taken that bail to mean that they are totally in
the crooks, and I don't pursue crooks. The other is keeping the body as it is, deciding which cases, and remember now, we're talking about 20,000 deaths a year in the state of Oregon, of which less than 150 are homicides. And the committee does not have time for war stories. However, should the committee wish, I could share enormous numbers of situations where very well-intentioned and well-meaning men and women in law enforcement without a medical background have misconstrued natural deaths with sadly some very tragic consequences to the families involved in these tragedies. And I can tell stories of families with crib deaths being appraised of their Miranda rights. So in response to your question, Representative Lombard, we have no question but that at the scene, the physician, and if there is a question of a crime, I want an attorney there, have responsibility. Chasing the crooks is not a section of our law. And I certainly have no intention whatsoever of asking the legislature to give me authority to chase crooks.
Let me put it to you this way, which is perhaps another way of asking the same thing. This, the question of death investigation, as established by this chapter, is separate, does not comprehend the pursuit of the of individuals who may have in fact committed a criminally caused death.
It does not, Mr. Chairman. It is not intended
death
to...
Death investigation as a term of art in this section of our code does not extend to that form of activity.
It does. That's correct. The phraseology which one of the physicians instructed me used is rather colloquial, but I think it's expressive. We tell them what did it. They tell us who did it. We're not Quincy. And I'm afraid that crazy TV show has misconstrued, I think, in the parts of some well-meaning people, my role. I do not, and I do not intend to, and none of the men and women on our program behave in the fashion that Mr. Klugman does in many of his shows. That's unreal. It sells soap, but it's not what we do. There's a separation, and I believe you identified it very precisely, Mr. Chairman.
Sheriff, in the conduct of investigation beyond these different aspects we've been noting here, ordering an autopsy, preserving the condition at the scene, and so forth, are your officials under the control of the district attorney so far as the conduct of the investigation of who committed a death,
that's
which has been established by this procedure as at least possibly caused by criminal means?
That's our only problem.
But this, 'cause this bill goes well beyond that question.
If we could get the district attorneys to agree with Mr. Brady that that's all the law says, there would be absolutely no problem.
We have a missing ingredient.
No problem. But I insist to you that the district attorneys are not interpreting the statute as Mr. Brady just stated. We could get that cleared up. We would be most happy, and there would be no problem.
You understand my point?
Yes, sir.
But the bill is, whatever else it does, is sweeping into a changed relationship aspects that do not go to the question of, as Dr. Brady put it, who did it? And that was what I understood to be your principal complaint, that in the pursuit of alleged perpetrators of criminal homicides,
yes,
your role was unfairly controlled by another elected official.
That's right. I recall when the bill was written. Back my district attorney played a very strong role in writing current law. I didn't oppose that law at that time because in my reading of the statute, I was under the impression that we were talking about the cause of death. And I thought it was a very appropriate bill, a very appropriate law for establishing cause of death. They most certainly ought to do that. The ongoing criminal investigation, the apprehension of the criminal, that's law enforcement responsibility. And I am not aware of any district attorneys in the state of Oregon that are interpreting this bill that way. There may be one or two, or I don't know. I'm not aware of any. They're interpreting the bill as stated by Dr. Brady. If they were, we wouldn't be here.
Upon what provisions of law do the district attorneys rely in purporting to direct, in a controlling way, the conduct of the investigation beyond the scope of death investigation? Can you tell me that? I'm not saying there isn't such a provision, but do you know if there is a provision of the code that purports to give them authority over that segment of?
No, I think it's their interpretation of the bill.
Of this law?
Yes, of this law, of this law. It's their interpretation of this law. They interpret this law as giving them and the district attorney exclusive control over the cause of death, investigation of death, the total investigation. That's the way it is interpreted. I don't believe that was the way it was ever intended.
President Courtney,
do you know where the DAs are?
Where they are? Today, right now?
Well, I know where they are, but I...
on this bill?
On this bill, I'm
going to tell you. Are you speaking for the district attorneys, Dr. Brady? Also?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Courtney, Mr. John Collins, who is the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I spoke this morning. Mr. Collins gave me the authority to convey to the committee, number one, that he would endeavor to be here to testify in opposition to the bill today. And I haven't thanked Linda for calling me this morning, but neither Mr. Collins nor I were aware until this morning that the bill was to have a hearing this afternoon. So he apologizes. He had another commitment. He was attempting to come. He secondly authorized me to state that at a meeting of the Legislative Committee of the Oregon District Attorneys Association held last Wednesday evening, the committee, which has the authority of the association to speak for the association in matters before the legislature, unanimously voted their opposition to the bill, which I think is not unexpected by the chair.
Well, I think one thing that's emerged from this hearing is that apart from how the issue that you have raised, Sharon, with respect to the investigation of determining who may have committed an unlawfully caused death, that is not what this bill gets to, though. This bill, it seems to me, is directed at the death investigation stage,
not the further stage of determining who may have committed, perpetrated a crime.
You're exactly right. You think today just exactly like I thought when this bill was passed. But that isn't the way the district attorneys of the state of Oregon interpret that bill. And my point is,
and I don't know that the committee has any very informed judgment yet about the issue you have raised. I think we'll have to pursue that carefully. But my point is, this bill does not directly address that problem. It is making changes with respect to other areas of responsibility, which it seems to me there's a very good case for preserving in their present relationships.
It doesn't. I agree with what you say, but at least, if nothing else, it makes us a part of that process. The bill that's before you now makes us a part of that process.
Let me ask you another question, Sheriff. Do you not agree with Dr. Brady's concern, which I guess is reflected in the present law, that there must be some built-in safeguards with respect to assuring that persons who have the kind of responsibilities embraced within death investigation have passed a threshold of certain judgments about qualifications to do that work?
Oh, most certainly. Most certainly, I agree.
And would you say that the present process of identifying such persons is a good process? The process of identifying who may act as deputy medical examiners, do you think that the machinery of that is a good working process?
Oh, yes, I think it is, except that, you know, in due respect to Mr. Brady, all qualified people are not on his list. Our district attorney, for example, has a tendency to limit that number. We'll give you this agency, we'll give you two, we'll give you four. In my own agency, I have more of the probably than any other agency in the county. But that most certainly doesn't mean that I don't have others that are equally qualified to do the same things those officers could do.
Mr. Courtney?
Just quickly, your examples of 40 miles out on the boondocks in the middle of the morning, that was a situation where you didn't have someone qualified out there, right?
It wasn't a medical examiner or a deputy medical examiner, no. But he can't.
See, I'm getting confused here because to me, if you buy what Dr. Brady has said, basically, if you want people who are qualified out there, then this bill would do damage to that, wouldn't it? Because that would allow those individuals who were out there at the time, I assume from what you're saying, you said I had a deputy out there, it was 40 miles out there. Would not this bill, you use bill in a number of ways, but this piece of legislation before us, would that not have allowed that individual to go ahead, that deputy, regardless of qualifications? Sheriff, am I confusing you in my question?
Well, I think it's not intended to eliminate anything that Dr. Brady, the medical examiner, or the district attorney does at the crime scene. I don't think we intend to eliminate any of those things. But we think that in the preservation of evidence, we think that the senior police officer present ought to be able to do that. He ought to be able to rope the area off.
Representative Courtney, may I respond to your question? This bill, if it were passed, would give that gentleman that you just referred to the authority that's outlined here, and you've read the bill, so you know what this is. Sir, we're talking about turf. Now, let's strip everything else away. Right here, we're talking about turf. Certainly. The deputy medical examiners in any county consist of, by law, the sheriff, by law, someone from the Oregon State Police, and by law, other selected law enforcement officers. Now, the sheriff and I are both big boys, and we travel the state of Oregon enough to know the problems that occur when an experienced law enforcement officer from one jurisdiction is, under our statute, given authority to investigate a death.
in another law enforcement jurisdiction. There are problems. The sheriff knows it, I know it, and we're all big boys. And this is one of the issues that this bill is addressing. In other words, is my turf protected, or is a responsible, trained, qualified person who's not from my agency to come in to my area? That's what we're talking about here. And my program is, my God, man, in this day of limited government resources, I don't give a darn what uniform that person comes in. I want the best person that I possibly can get in. If he or she is from the sheriff's office, from the city police, from the state police, I don't look at their uniform, I look at their training and qualifications. Now, I know there's a rub here, and here's what we're talking about.
Questions? Sheriff, did you have some more?
No, except that I don't quite interpret it that way. We don't have that. That isn't really what we're talking about. We're talking about what we're talking about is the prosecutor who, in this state, in most ever county, is probably the least qualified criminal investigator in that county. One of the least. Most instances, he's a brand new fellow out of law school, never been on the death scene. A lot of them. We got three or four of them right in our building. And those people are interpreting this bill to set them up as the chief investigator, the director of those ongoing investigations. Crack that problem, there would be no problem.
Well, as I said earlier, without regard yet to the merits of that issue, this bill does not speak to investigation of perpetrators in the sense I think we're describing it. It speaks to death investigation.
Yes. And we're not trying to eliminate any authority that's in there now.
Oh, no. I understand that, although...
We're only trying to contribute.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. We'll take one more bill before we are recessed. We'll take the television appearance bill, which I think we can move through rather rapidly. 2449. Let's see. Sheriff Dolan again.
Sheriff Dolan from Benton County. I only wanted to bring to your attention that the Sheriff's Association is not opposed to this concept. In fact, many of our jurisdictions are looking to this as a possible way to reduce some of the cost of transport to courts. We recognize there would be some costs in implementing such a program, and we wouldn't want to make it mandatory that we had to do it, but we're certainly in favor.
You know, I think it's a very constructive concept, and we'll have some more staff comments in a moment that we've developed in the wake of discussion of this bill with Jim Hinning, public defender. I think he has some suggestions for the subcommittee that perhaps we can use to even broaden the bill somewhat.
There are some sheriffs that have traveled to other jurisdictions to look at various programs, and I think even without enabling legislation, there are a few people that are looking at it as a possibility. I guess we were naive to think that we would have to have legislation to allow us to do it, but we do see it as being a reasonable use of technology for some cost reduction and some improvements of our system.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Cannon?
May it please the committee, my name is Bob Cannon, Marion County Legal Counsel. The bill was originally written by myself with the assistance of Frank Gruber of Legislative Counsel, Chris Van Dyke, and through the courtesy of the Marion County delegations before you at this time. I'd like to indicate that a very brief background is necessary to set this in perspective. In 1864, that's not 1964, that's 1864, the present provisions of ORS Chapter 135 were established. The present provisions of the arraignment statute are set forth in the Oregon Constitution. But the statutory language is from 1864. It provides that a person charged with a misdemeanor need not personally appear before the court. It also provides, the legislation, provides that a person charged with a felony must personally appear. This came up at the tail end of the 1981 legislative session. Marion County, as you know, is the has the courtesy of having several major penal institutions in its jurisdiction. This causes us tremendous fiscal problems. I went to Chris Van Dyke and I said, Chris, I cannot, as legal counsel for the county, request an AG's opinion, but I'd like to have you do it for me. And the county would pick up the tab. We did that. June 22nd of 81, Chris wrote on my behalf to Dave Frohnmayer and said, basically, we want to know if it is lawful for the Marion County Circuit Court to conduct closed circuit video arraignments, television. If closed circuit video arraignments are lawful, can the arraignments be held at the Oregon State Penitentiary, the Oregon State Women's Correctional Center, the Oregon State Correctional Institution, and the Marion County Jail? The opinion, which is AG Opinion 5212, came back and basically said that for misdemeanors, it is lawful. For felonies, it would be unlawful under the statutory provisions of ORS Chapter 135. In each instance, it is not unconstitutional, either under the Oregon Constitution or the United States Constitution, to have TV or video arraignments. Now, let me also indicate to you how the system would work. As you're well aware, an arraignment is simply a presentation to the court of the individual, and the individual is given a copy, and either the copy is read or the reading is waived, of the accusatory instrument. The individual camera and television units would be established at each institution. A master control unit would be established in Marion County Courthouse, which would include equipment for recording the arraignments. So each one of these instances, these occurrences of coming before the court, would be videotaped. The equipment is sufficiently sophisticated to allow constant two-way visual and two-way audio communications between the judge and the inmate. Public television sets in the hallways or courtrooms of the Marion County Courthouse would be established to provide for live television simultaneous viewing and listening by any person who wanted to be present, quote-unquote, at the arraignment. Attorneys would be permitted into the institutions for the purposes of the arraignment. Now, at the first arraignment, the individual is served with a copy of the grand jury indictment charging the inmate with a felony. Now, many of the charges that arise in Marion County are escapes. We simply place a lot of people at Prigg Cottage and at the farm annex, and they happen to find greener pastures somewhere else. And in the process, they are charged with a Class C felony. At the first arraignment, the person is just comes before the judge and they are given a copy of the accusatory instrument. That person, by statute, cannot plead guilty without an attorney. So at the first arraignment, all they are given is a piece of paper. They are not even allowed to plead, generally. The second arraignment, they are appointed an attorney. The attorney is present, and generally we have a plea of not guilty because the attorney has yet to see the police reports or an opportunity to consult with his client. I have had a great deal of assistance from Frank Gruber, and I'd like to indicate that I've had a great deal of assistance from John Ruling, Chief Counsel of the Opinion Section. Our staff has done also a great deal of work. Las Vegas presently has a closed circuit television system. There is presently such a system in Suffolk County, Massachusetts, in Phoenix, Arizona. And the California Attorney General's Office has, in fact, also written an opinion indicating that video arraignments are appropriate. The cost to Marion County is approximately $20 a day per inmate being transported between any of the institutions and the courthouse. There is also, with reduced staff, reduced availability of patrol officers, the opportunity for escape. There was one dramatic escape which occurred in 1977, which resulted in a woman having her car stolen from her in the parking lot of Meyer and Frank, and there was a high-speed chase that resulted out on Hayesville Road with the car being wrecked. That inmate would not have escaped had it not been for this type of system which allows the possibility for escape. You can talk about fiscal requirements all you want to, and we do have limited resources in Marion County, but the first thing is protection of the public, and this does provide for that protection. The second thing, and of course the thing that we're most important, is the money. This would save us money. It would help our sheriff, and it would take off the problem of having the chain gang always coming into our jail and being before the court. We have to staff each courtroom with 3 officers, and this system is constitutional. We need a statutory change. If I can answer any questions, I'd be most happy to.
Have you reviewed the public defender's proposed amendments?
No, I haven't.
Would you provide Mr. Cannon a copy of those? Mr. Henning's principal concern, as I interpret his amendments, was to include a provision which appears there at the bottom that a specific provision that facilities must be available in a way that would enable the defendant to consult with the defendant's counsel in private during the proceedings. I gather that the way you envision it occurring would be consistent with that in any event.
Yes, certainly. An individual has the right to counsel and the right to confer with counsel in private at any time during the criminal process, as far as I'm concerned, being an old member of the public defender's office.
The other question I have is off of your remarks about public access to the proceedings in the sense of one or more locations. If the measure is otherwise approved by the subcommittee, do we need any language that assures that the total arrangement provides that kind of public access to the total proceedings, or is that unnecessary?
I think that's unnecessary in light of Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution, which specifically provides that all courts shall be open and public. If this type of procedure were enacted without a public viewing screen and audio arraignment, I think it probably would be constitutional. At least in my mind, it would be.
Would be.
Unconstitutional.
Well, I guess the only concern I had was whether we would leave that provision on the assumption that we would simply rest on that provision and assume no one would inadvertently slip up in the first round of implementing such a statute, or whether we would need to make that explicit.
I would certainly have no objection whatsoever to having that included. I don't think it's necessary.
Questions of Mr. Cannon? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair would move the adoption of the public defender amendments as distributed to the subcommittee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lombard?
Do I gather then that what you're doing is you're substituting the public defender's amendments for the bill amendments?
Yes.
Okay. A motion to send it? Then
yes, let's see if subcommittee is ready to
move the bill to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Mr. Lombard moves that House Bill 2449, as amended, be reported to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll.
Gordon?
Yes.
Mills?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Chair?
Aye. Linda, oh, I'm sorry. Thanks for getting to see you. Did the discussions that Jim Hennings had with you and the listing that he prepared that you mentioned beforehand, was these amendments intended to reflect all of those?
No, Mr. Chair, his amendments only respond to the arraignment procedure still, but he was suggesting that there may be other circumstances in which they would have no objection to a similar sort of simultaneous TV appearance by a defendant.
You want to review those quickly for us?
Other possibilities where he suggested that it may be okay, and I don't think he absolutely said that it ought to be, in all cases should be, but was a, he said, first appearance in technical matters, possibly in bail or release hearings, pro forma discovery, motions for setovers. He did say that in cases like actually the trial, preliminary hearings, and sentencing, that there should be absolutely a real personal appearance. And in some instances where it was maybe a factually disputed issue, that there should certainly be a right, an option of the defendant to appear, for example, if it were a motion to suppress. So we didn't go through and list everything, but conceptually that's the direction he was heading. More technical matters being ones where there wouldn't be necessarily a need for the defendant to be personally present.
I think if there's no objection, what I'll do is let the bill go on as we have voted it, and the staff and I will work further with Mr. Hennings to see if we can refine some additional amendments. If it appears those are of a nature that would require the subcommittee to spend more time on, I'll put the bill back on our agenda for the consideration of those amendments if there are some developed. If it appears that they might be fairly easily added to the bill at the full committee level, without a great deal of difficulty, technically or otherwise, if there's no objection, we'll just do that at the full committee. Okay. Okay. 5 minute recess.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
I'm still putting them in. I'll add mine.
Who gives a damn? I know. Let me.
He's jealous because he was better
read than them.
The subcommittee will return to order.
Okay.
Our next bill is House Bill 2450. Don't have anyone on the sign up sheet, but I assume the Political Action Committee is representative. Yes, come on.
Is this your bill, right? That's your bill. That's your one. Would you keep it over there, please?
Sorry. I was really careful.
Excuse me, sorry.
My name is Gail Castillo, and I'm president of the Hispanic Political Action Committee. And I, first of all, wanted to thank all of you for taking the time and allowing us to testify in favor of this.